So it's really a great pleasure to be able to introduce Jeff Martin to you. Jeff and I have been at several kinds of science, theology sorts of meetings over the last few years. It's always been a pleasure to be around him. So I was really happy to hear that we were able to have him come and talk tonight. And so let me give you just a little bit of background on him, and then we'll turn things over to Jeff. So Dr. Jeff Martin is a professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he's also a chair of the zoology department. He did his PhD studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and then did postdoctoral work at Duke University. He's done a lot of work on cell biology and embryonic development. So some of the things that he will be speaking of tonight will come out of reflections as a Christian and as a scientist working on in these kinds of areas. Now, one thing that you may not know about Professor Hardin is that he also has an MDiv, a Master's of Divinity, from the International School of Theology in Southern California. So he also has been quite reflective from the Christian side in terms of thinking about scientific issues. He also serves on the National Advisory Board for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and has been active with the graduate chapter there at the university where he works. And he's also currently chair of the board of directors of BioLogos and is an ASA member. So will you join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Jeff Martin?
Thank you, Robert. What Robert didn't mention is that he very patiently tried to get me to come to Wheaton for a very long time and failed. So and that's all on me. Robert is a fantastic guy, and Ray has been a tremendous host today. Now, Madison's not that far from Wheaton, but I've only been here one other time. That's when my son, who is now 30, was in middle school. We came down here for a youth ministry conference in the summertime. So, never actually seen this place with students. Like, there are some, so that's really great. It's really an honor for me to be here. I mean, Wheaton is. Wheaton is really a flagship university in the Christian world here in North America, and so its mission and what God is doing through Wheaton, I think, is something that you can all be proud of, and certainly people like me are very, very grateful for the rich tradition here. It goes back a long way of thinking well about science and thinking well about Christian faith. So hopefully I'll be at least a small part of that tradition tonight. What we're going to talk about tonight, there's going to be a bit of technology that we're going to have to talk about. But just for my own amusement, how many of you have some training in biology? Okay. And does that include some genetics? Anybody? Yeah, fewer. Okay. So we're going to have to talk a little bit about this important molecule. You may have heard of it. It's called DNA. So we will talk about that tonight. I will try to keep the technical jargon to a minimum. And the slides may have more information than you need to know in a couple of cases. So don't worry. We'll try to talk through everything. Let me start. I'm a developmental biologist, so I study how embryos develop. And let's just take my life. Well, you can argue whether I'm actually an adult, but my adult life. So kind of from time I graduated from high school until just a couple of years ago. Let's just look at what's happened. 1978, I graduated in 1977 from high school. First in vitro fertilization baby, Louise Brown. Quickly following on from that, surrogate motherhood, other reproductive technologies. And then we have things like this. This is from 1993, the cover of Time, intentional splitting of human embryos. 1997, Dolly the sheep, the first mammal who was cloned from the nucleus from a somatic cell. In 2001, we had human embryonic stem cells, and so you have the cover of Newsweek looking like this, the Stem Cell Wars. And my colleague, Jamie Thompson, University of Wisconsin, was right in the middle of that because he developed the technology. 5 years later, 2006, Shinya Yamanaka developed what are called induced pluripotent cells. We'll talk more about those later. They are an amazing kind of cell that we can use for all kinds of potential biomedical interventions. 2007, the first primate was cloned. This is a Cynos, rhesus macaque, very handsome. One of my favorite stories is this is a mouse that was frozen in liquid nitrogen for 16 years. Nuclei were isolated from this mouse, and cloned mice were produced from this. I only mention it because it's crazy. So.
That's a mad city.
Yeah, that's right. Just a couple of years ago, a few years ago now, Fen Zhang and George Church were part of a large group of scientists, including Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, who developed the technology we're going to spend a lot of time talking about tonight, CRISPR-Cas9, and we'll talk about what that is. That's a way to genetically engineer pretty much any piece of DNA in most organisms. In 2013, there was an announcement that humans had been cloned for the intent of making stem cells. So there's been an onslaught of biomedical technologies, and it seems like the train is picking up speed. And that's a challenge for us as Christians. And unfortunately, we may be tempted to allow all of the professionals to think about these things, let them think through the answers. But I resonate with something that G.K. Chesterton said, and I just saw some artifacts of Chesterton down the road here on my way in here. Ray showed me some of the amazing library holdings here, pretty impressive. But here's what G.K. said, eminently quotable fellow. If the ordinary person may not discuss existence, why should he or she be asked to conduct it? All of us need to think about these technologies, because ultimately, the 21st century is the century of biology. And in fact, it is very likely that everyone in this room, or at least many of us, or our loved ones, will need to decide about ethically challenging therapies, and that includes some of the technologies we're going to talk about tonight. There's another biblical reason why we need to think about this, and that comes from the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5. Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by people." We are called to be a leavening, salting influence on society. So we need to think well about these things as Christians if we're going to interface with that wider world. All right, so what we're going to talk about tonight is a way to engineer DNA, and pretty much any piece of DNA. And I told you I would mention this magical molecule, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. And remember that DNA provides the information to make proteins. And there's an intermediate called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. And one of the two strands of a piece of DNA, after the DNA is separated, is transcribed. That's the pink material in the middle. And then that information is read out three subunits at a time to string together a group of amino acids into a protein. So by engineering DNA, we are indirectly engineering the protein that cells can make using that DNA as the starting information. And editing DNA then can be a very powerful way to edit proteins that are being made by cells in an organism. Now, there have been ways to do this for a long time. In fact, my lab uses some of these technologies. So we can add genetic material to some organisms. That's called making a transgenic. We can also remove pieces of DNA from an organism or replace them. An older technology by which this is accomplished, which I'll mention very briefly, is to swap in a piece of DNA, either one that works or a piece of DNA that's not the original and does something different, via a mechanism called homologous recombination. It just means we're putting it in the same place where the original gene was. And there are ways of doing this in certain organisms. They don't work for humans for several obvious reasons that I'll mention. What we're going to spend most of our time focusing on technologically tonight is a technology known as genome editing, or gene editing. And so we'll talk about that in some detail, because it's going to change the way we think about these kinds of technologies forever. So here's an example of making a transgenic animal. These are mice. They've been genetically engineered so that they are producing a protein that glows. When you shine blue light on the mice, they glow green, because this is something called the green fluorescent protein. So these are amazing party tricks. And in fact, this works in lower primates, marmosets. These are genetically engineered marmosets that express that same green protein. That's by adding in a piece of DNA, the cells will take that added information and make a protein. Right, I also told you there were classical ways to take a piece of DNA, swap out the normal piece of DNA, and insert something different at the same spot. And when we use that to genetically alter mice, then we call that making a knockout mouse or a knock-in mouse, depending on whether we just get rid of a piece of DNA or put in a new piece of DNA that does something different. And this involved a pretty complicated technology where you made a piece of DNA that matched a region of a gene. Now, a lot of times, that DNA just goes in any old place. Very, very rarely, our piece of DNA gets inserted in the right place, the normal place that DNA corresponds to. And that's, as I said, something called homologous recombination. There's a way to select for that thing on the left here. And then you can take the cells in which that has occurred. It's a very rare event, but you can find cells in which it happens. And then you can insert them into a recipient mouse embryo, and they'll take part in making a mouse. And then you can take the mouse you get from this embryo, and put it into a surrogate mother and do some other things. You take those mice and you do some breeding, and eventually what you get out of that is a genetically engineered mouse, if you're really lucky, and you spent months to over a year doing this. And so those technologies were available, and they work great for mice, which are kind of the workhorse for studying mammals. We happen to be mammals, so mice are kind of a model for studying us. And it's been very powerful. So if you figured this out, you got a piece of the Nobel Prize. So this is Mario Capecchi, Martin Evans, and Oliver Smithies for a time was at Wisconsin. Then he left us to go to UNC Chapel Hill, which, given the fact that I did my postdoc at Duke, is very disappointing. But Oliver recently passed away, actually. This technology, it turns out, works with human cells. So human embryonic stem cells are special cells originally derived from human embryos, in which we can do the same technology. So in this case, here are some human embryonic stem cells that have not been engineered, and so they don't glow in the dark when you shine blue light on them. But these guys up here have had a piece of DNA inserted, which allows these cells to make this glowing green protein, the green fluorescent protein, and that's what you see on the upper right. So this basic technology can be used to engineer human cells, and it's pretty successful. But there's some downsides to this technology. This is very inefficient. So this technology is very, the particular way that you put the DNA in to a chromosome only happens very rarely. It's really labor intensive. With mice, you've got to do all this breeding. And that means you're not going to use that on a human. Obviously. You're not going to try to breed humans to get a genetically engineered human out of this for many, many reasons, practical, ethical, and otherwise. So what we'd like is an alternative to this very labor-intensive way of swapping in a piece of DNA that we've engineered to do something. We'd like to find a more efficient way to do that. And that's where genome editing comes in. And this is really changing the way we think about altering DNA in animals or other organisms, plants, and humans. So let's talk about some ways to do this new kind of technology. So first of all, well, what is this? Well, a genome is just the collective DNA in the cells of an organism. So your genome is all of the chromosomes in your cells, 46 chromosomes in your somatic cells, the cells of your body, and all the DNA associated with those. And all this technology involves is chopping the DNA at specific sites, not at random, but at a very specific place that you have identified where you want to put the DNA in or make a cut. And an enzyme that does that, if you want a fancy word for that, it's called an endonuclease. It's molecular scissors. Chops the DNA. So we have that chopping enzyme that does that. And we'll talk about how to get it to chop the specific place where we want. But then it turns out, once you've chopped DNA, it turns out that your cells are developing breaks in your DNA all the time. And your cells have a way to repair those breaks. That's a normal part of maintaining the health of your cells. So when your DNA breaks, there are various kinds of strategies that your cells use to repair the damage, glue the broken pieces of DNA back together. Because breaks in DNA are bad, especially when you want to try to divide. So the cell has DNA repair machinery. We created the break with those molecular scissors, and now we're going to repair the damage using the cell's own repair machinery. Now, if we don't give the cell anything to work with, it's just going to try to glue those broken pieces of DNA together as best it can. And almost always when that happens, the resulting DNA loses the ability to encode the information to make a functional protein. Normally, you make an aborted sort of protein. It just doesn't work anymore. And that process of just gluing the DNA together, if you want a big word for that, you've had some genetics, is called non-homologous end joining. The ends don't match. We're just going to stick them like crazy glue together. Now, it turns out, though, that if there's a good piece of DNA the cell can use to base its repair on, the cell uses a different kind of mechanism. And so if we give the cell a piece of DNA to use as a template for the repair of the broken piece of DNA that the molecular scissors up here created, then the cell will use a different kind of repair called homology-directed repair. All right? So if we give a repair template, a piece of DNA that the cell can work off of, it will repair the break, but it will use the information provided by the DNA that we gave the cell. Okay? So basic two things that can happen. All right, so it turns out that there are at least three. There's one I won't mention called meganuclease, but there are three ways that people have been using to do this very thing. Take the molecular scissors, cause them to chop the DNA at a very specific location, and either make the DNA non-functional to break the gene on purpose, or to swap in a piece of DNA that allows the gene to do something different, or engineers a slightly different version of that gene. So one of these is called a transcription activator-like effector nuclease, or a TALEN. And these things sit on a piece of DNA, and they have elements that allow these things to bind to the DNA. These are proteins, and they bind a very specific part along a piece of DNA. And then the purple jelly bean in the middle is the molecular scissors part, and it chops the DNA at two sites to make breaks. Something similar is called a zinc finger nuclease. So the doodads that grab onto the DNA is different. Got the molecular scissors in the middle. It does the same thing. And so the cutting enzyme is targeted to a specific place because it turns out that these proteins only bind a specific part of DNA. So these can target the molecular scissors to a particular spot that we, so that allows us to work with a particular piece of DNA. Alright, the one that's really caught everybody's attention though is this guy. This is a molecular complex of proteins from a bacterium, and this is called, the system that we're going to use here is called CRISPR-Cas9. I'm only going to say the acronym once, and then it's going to be CRISPR. Because it stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. These are pieces of DNA, and we'll see where they come from in a second. Cas stands for CRISPR-associated genes. One of these is one of those molecular scissors, Cas9. All right. So Cas9 is going to be the DNA cutter, and then there's a molecular machinery that is going to target the cutting to a specific spot of DNA. That's really all we're going to do. All right. You may wonder, well, where did this come from? Well, it turns out that molecular biologists studying bacteria discovered that bacteria carry in their genes, their DNA, scars, evidence that their progenitors, previous ancestors, had been infected by viruses that attack bacteria. And it turned out that the pieces of viral DNA, like this thing up at the top here, pieces of that DNA end up getting stuck into the DNA of the bacteria. So there are these elements shown by the green and blue colors here that are stuck into the bacterium's DNA. But they came from a virus. You may wonder, well, what's that about? Well, it turns out that bacteria, a bacteria that has this DNA, when it gets infected by a virus, it kicks in an antiviral defense, and it uses those little pieces of viral DNA that were kicking around in its DNA. And so what happens is that the DNA is transcribed to make that intermediate kind of molecule called RNA. That's the gray things here. And a second kind of RNA, which is called a tracker RNA for transactivating CRISPR RNA. We're not going to use that word again after this slide. Those get together, and it turns out that the green or the blue here is used to seek out and chop a piece of the viral DNA if that bacterium is infected by a virus. The virus injects its DNA into the bacterium. The bacterium says, I need to kill that stuff. So this is an elaborate method for the bacterium to seek out DNA that doesn't belong to itself and cut it and render it inactive. So that's where the basic system comes from. But, you know, most things in bacteria have been now engineered to our advantage to use in non-bacterial cells. So the technology uses this natural process, but modifies it into a technological advance. And so here's how this basic system works. Here's how we can use this system to do genome editing. Remember I said that if we chop a piece of DNA, your cells will try to fix it. But if we give your cells a piece of DNA to use as a pattern for the repair, we'll use a different process. Remember that? So one of two things can happen if I devise a way to chop your DNA. If I chop your DNA and I don't give your cells anything, then they'll just try to glue the ends together and it will render the gene non-functional most of the time. But if I give it a pattern, it will use that pattern which with matching DNA elements to repair the break
And now I have a new engineered piece of DNA. And this system uses an engineered version of the bacterial defense mechanism to accomplish this. And that's what's going on up here. So we can engineer almost any gene using this technology. To do it, we engineer something that allows the cell to make a piece of RNA called a guide RNA. That's this thing up here. So there's a part that allows this to kind of sit on this complex that does this chopping. And the guide RNA, the green part, matches a piece of DNA that we want to engineer. So we already have to know the DNA that we want to mess with, but we know that for most organisms, and we know it for humans as well, because the entire genome of humans has been sequenced. So we've got a gene we want to mess with in a human cell. We design a piece of DNA that allows that cell to make this guide RNA, this thing up here. It's like a heat-seeking missile. It goes to the DNA and allows the DNA to be cut. Now, we have to allow the cells to make this bacterial enzyme system, this CRISPR-Cas9 system. So we give the cell all of these tools. Then we let the cell do its thing. It makes all this stuff, targets the molecular scissors, the enzyme, to the DNA that we want, cuts the DNA, either rendering it broken, or if we give it something to work with to repair, then we can engineer the DNA. So providing this repair template is what allows us to engineer the DNA in very specific ways. Okay? Now, you may not have followed certain things that I just said. It's okay.
Because we'll give you a video a little bit. Now, what are some pros and cons of this method? Well, pros, almost any gene can be targeted. I already said that. This is rapid and cheap. If this works, you can get this to work in a week or two versus a year. Huge time savings. It's cheap. So actually, people have developed kits to do some basic CRISPR-Cas9 work with bacteria in your garage, if you want. Okay, cons? Well, all of these endonuclease-mediated genome editing technologies, the molecular scissors bit, rely on the fact that we target the molecular scissors to just the right spot. If you just willy-nilly chop up all your DNA, that would be bad. I don't think I need to say much more about that. That willy-nilly cutting would be called an off-target effect, where we're chopping a gene we didn't intend to chop. So original versions of this technology had fairly substantial off-target effects. But now further engineering of this system has gotten the reliability up to be very high. But it's still an issue. Because this is so cheap and rapid, we have people who they're now being called biohackers, who can do this. It's so easy that almost anybody can do this with certain kinds of organisms, at least. So this is an issue. Maybe a little too easy. Right? All right, so let's watch a little video to recap what I've said. And so let's just make sure. Okay, do you have a sound? Ready? Here we go.
Every cell in our body contains a copy of our genome, over 20,000 genes, 3 billion letters of DNA. DNA consists of two strands twisted into a double helix and held together by a simple pairing rule. A pairs with T and G pairs with C. Our genes shape who we are as individuals and as a species. Genes also have profound effects on health. And thanks to advances in DNA sequencing, researchers have identified thousands of genes that affect our risk of disease. To understand how genes work, researchers need ways to control them. Changing genes in living cells is not easy. But recently, a new method has been developed that promises to dramatically improve our ability to edit the DNA of any species, including humans. The CRISPR method is based on a natural system used by bacteria to protect themselves from infection by viruses. When the bacterium detects the presence of virus DNA, it produces two types of short RNA, one of which contains a sequence that matches that of the invading virus. These two RNAs form a complex with a protein called Cas9. Cas9 is a nuclease, a type of enzyme that can cut DNA. When the matching sequence, known as a guide RNA, finds its target within the viral genome, the Cas9 cuts the target DNA, disabling the virus. Over the past few years, researchers studying the system realized that it could be engineered to cut not just viral DNA, but any DNA sequence at a precisely chosen location by changing the guide RNA to match the target. And this can be done not just in a test tube, but also within the nucleus of a living cell. Once inside the nucleus, the resulting complex will lock onto a short sequence known as the PAN. The Cas9 will unzip the DNA and match it to its target RNA. If the match is complete, the Cas9 will use two tiny molecular scissors to cut the DNA. When this happens, the cell tries to repair the cut, but the repair process is error-prone, leading to mutations that can disable the gene, allowing researchers to understand its function. These mutations are random, but sometimes researchers need to be more precise, for example, by replacing a mutant gene with a healthy copy. This can be done by adding another piece of DNA that carries the desired sequence. Once the CRISPR system has made a cut, this DNA template can pair up with the cut ends, recombining and replacing the original sequence with the new version. All this can be done in cultured cells, including stem cells that can give rise to many different cell types. It can also be done in a fertilized egg, allowing the creation of transgenic animals with targeted mutations. And unlike previous methods, CRISPR can be used to target many genes at once, a big advantage for studying complex human diseases that are caused not by a single mutation, but by many genes acting together. These methods are being improved rapidly and will have many applications in basic research, in drug development, in agriculture, and perhaps eventually for treating human patients with genetic disease.
I love that. You see that split-making animation? This is great. Okay, so this was generated by the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT. We'll see that MIT features prominently in some of the discussion about CRISPR-Cas. Okay, so I hope that was helpful. Kind of summarize what we've said so far. All right, so you get the sense that this is really going to change the game. This is, I don't like using the phrase game changer very much, but this is one. So let's see about ways that we can apply this very powerful technology. That's what we want to do next. All right, well, my lab uses this technology. We work with a little worm, kind of like learning a lot about a Mercedes by studying a Toyota, and we can genetically engineer these worms so that some of their proteins now have an extra piece that allows them to glow when we shine a particular wavelength of light on them. So this is one of the proteins that we work on imaged in this way. So this is a genetically engineered embryo. It was engineered using CRISPR-Cas9 technology. All right, how about some other applications? Well, agribusiness is all over this. So this is from a New York Times article from 2015. We're in 17, in case you lost track. And the title of this article was something like Open Season on Genome Editing in Agriculture. And one of the things that happens is cows in close quarters who are male who have horns can injure themselves. Hey, let's engineer cows so they don't have horns anymore. That's what was done here. So here's a normal juvenile
Sorry, not cow, bull, I mean bovine. And so here's, I'm a zoology professor. So here's a male juvenile, a bull, and here are two CRISPR-Cas9 genetically engineered bovines, male bovines. They do not have horns. We can do this with plants. We can do this with lots of different livestock varieties. It is happening, and it is happening quickly. Sorry about Emmanuel. She was at University of Vienna, and now I think she's at Emble Labs. Sorry about that X there. But it turns out because this is big business, there's a huge patent row going on right now. So Fen Zhang at the Broad Institute, which is a consortium of Harvard and MIT, you can imagine that's pretty high-powered, he submitted the first U.S. patents on CRISPR-Cas9 technology. And Emmanuel Charpentier is a microbiologist, and Jennifer Doudna is a structural biologist at my alma mater, UC Berkeley. They worked out a lot of the kinds of biochemical issues with CRISPR-Cas9, and they submitted a competing patent. So UC Berkeley is duking it out with Harvard, MIT, so heavyweight institutions, and this is a huge patent fight, potentially worth billions and billions of dollars. So very recently, in February, the first round went to the Broad Institute folks, and stay tuned. There'll be countersuits, and it's going to drag on for a long time. So there's a lot of money here, which is going to push the technology quickly because of the potential financial incentivization. All right, so in addition to commercial uses like the ones we just discussed, there's something else that people are proposing. That's something called a gene drive. A gene drive. So what is that? Well, imagine that you made an engineered version of a gene that's not just engineered, but the engineered version of the gene produces all of this molecular scissors apparatus to target the other copy of that same gene and render it non-functional. Imagine that that were true. Or not rendered it non-functional, but sorry, replaced the other copy of the gene with the engineered version. If you have a system where you can insert this engineered gene and it would swap out the other gene and replace it with itself, then you could propagate this engineered gene really, really quickly as cells divide. And so that idea is known as a gene drive. So here's how it works. I've got an engineered version of the gene. Here's the gene I want to mess with here. But I'm adding these other things that you should recognize the name of that are part of this engineering technology that we've been talking about. So if I introduce this piece of DNA into some cells of an organism, it's going to cut the other DNA and replace it with the engineered version. So I'm very rapidly going to get all of the flavor of the gene that I want to edit, it will take over in a population of organisms or cells. And the suggested use of this has been with really bad pests like malaria, mosquitoes that are infected with malarial parasites. And so this technology allows rapid spread of an engineered piece of DNA through a population. Because that's hard to understand what I just said.
Let's watch another
video. Ready? Okay, here we go.
Historically, scientists have been able to alter the traits of domesticated plants and animals, but have not been able to do this to wild populations. Here we use mosquitoes as an example to explain why most genome alterations designed by humans don't persist in nature, and how a recently proposed technology could change that. The transgenic mosquito, tinted blue, has an altered gene inserted into one of its chromosomes. When it mates with the wild-type mosquito, each parent contributes one copy of each chromosome to their offspring. Thus, only 50% of offspring will carry the altered gene, while the other half will inherit the wild-type version from both parents. Even if the altered gene doesn't reduce the likelihood of each mosquito surviving and reproducing, it may persist at a low frequency in the ocean of wild mosquitoes. or it might go extinct after several generations of especially unlucky inheritance. This process is what keeps us from entering wild mosquitoes to prevent them from transmitting diseases such as malaria or dengue. Team led by Kevin Esfeld at the Wyss Institute, the Harvard Medical School, and the Harvard School of Public Health has now outlined a way to build gene drives that can improve the odds that almost any altered gene will be inherited, potentially allowing them to spread through even wild populations. The proposal relides on the CRISPR-Cas9 system, a new genome editing technology co-developed by the same researchers at the Wyss. Gene drive mosquitoes carry both the altered gene, the genes for the Cas9 enzyme, and several guide RNAs that tell it where to cut. When passed to offspring, the guide RNAs direct Cas9 to cut the wild-type version of the gene inherited from the wild-type parent. The cell then copies both the altered gene and the drive when it repairs the damage. Because the mosquito now has two identical copies, one on each chromosome, all of its offspring will inherit the alteration in the gene drive. This same process will be repeated in subsequent generations, causing the alteration in the gene drive to spread through the population.
So you get the idea, and the idea is to engineer mosquitoes so that they are immune to the malarial parasites so they can't be carriers anymore. That's the idea. Okay. And it turns out, you may recognize this gentleman, Bill Gates.
Yeah, Bill and Melinda Gates are providing tons of money to promote this as part of the Gates Foundation because they want to eradicate certain diseases in underdeveloped countries, malaria being a huge problem. So there's some big supporters here. Now, what are some potential problems? Well, you can probably think of some, but let me just help you. One is the law of unintended consequences. I'll call this the Jeff Goldblum problem. You know, from Jurassic Park, life finds a way, right? That's Jeff Goldblum. That is a huge potential problem. Do we really understand ecosystems enough to know what will happen if we get rid of all the mosquitoes in the ecosystem? There's actually been co-evolution of malarial resistance in human populations, among others. So, you know what? Do we really know what we're doing? Well, I'm not clear. Is there a do-over? Can we reverse this? People are working on ways to do what are called safety drives to undo what's been done. And that's possible using CRISPR-Cas9 technology. But the safety drives might not be 100% effective. And in the U.S. anyways, this is complete regulatory mayhem with government agencies. And it depends on what you're working on. It's a tangle of inconsistency. If it's something that's usually generates a food product, then it's the FDA regulating it. The USDA regulated, the Department of Agriculture. If it's something that's related to making some sort of pharmaceutical, then it's the FDA. If it's some non-edible thing, then it's the Environmental Protection Agency. It's all very complicated, and they all have different rules. So that's just kind of a mess. All right, so those are some applications of CRISPR-Cas9 that are worth thinking about, I think. But now let's talk about the real bread and butter here. You may have noticed in the first video that I showed that it's possible to inject DNA that can allow editing in an embryo or a zygote. So it's possible to consider should we think about editing the DNA of humans in a way that will be passed on through sperm or oocytes. Through normal reproductive processes. We'll get to that. First, though, let's talk about a potential use of this technology that a lot of people are excited about in the area of regenerative medicine. So remember, we talked about this gentleman, Nobel laureate, Shinya Yamanaka. He developed a way to produce cells, to coax cells to behave like the very flexible cells known as stem cells. And this is called induced pluripotency. So this basic technology is to force a group of cells to express four proteins. Those four proteins are called Yamanaka factors in his honor by most people.
if cells start producing these four proteins, they get tricked into thinking that they should be stem cells, and they become stem cells that are very, very flexible, which are called pluripotent. So we've induced them to become incredibly flexible, induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells. And then we can take those cells and put them in different environments, and we can turn them into many, many cell types. And because we started with cells that are matched to a human patient, once we transform these cells into the cells we need, muscle cells or heart cells or nervous system cells, you name it, they will be genetically matched to that patient. So there won't be immune rejection. A lot of really great thinking about that. Well, these are cells. You can engineer them using CRISPR-Cas9, and that's what has been proposed. Now, people knew this would probably work from some work that was done in mice using the old-fashioned technology of homologous recombination. So there was a mouse model for sickle cell disease, a disease of red blood cells involving protein hemoglobin. And cells were taken from the tail of such a mouse. They were forced to make the Yamanaka factors. Whammo, they got transformed into iPS cells. And then those iPS cells, the DNA of those cells, was genetically altered to repair the defective gene for hemoglobin. Then those repaired cells were coaxed to become blood cells, and they were injected into that mouse. And you know what? They rescued that mouse, the mouse that didn't have the sickle cell trait anymore. So the idea here is that if we could use CRISPR-Cas9 to engineer human iPS cells, they could be introduced into a patient after a genetic defect that that patient has in his or her cells is repaired. That's the idea. But in this case, it would be a specific set of cells that leads to a specific disease condition, not all the cells in the person's body. And that's an important distinction. All right, so people are trying these. Here's the first report that I know of, anyway. It's from 2015. There's a disease called retinitis pigmentosa. This is, in some cases, is caused by a well-known mutation, a genetic defect in a particular gene that provides the information to make a particular protein. And iPS cells were repaired using CRISPR-Cas9 and injected into the retina of the particular patient. And the particular patient showed some improvement in his retina. I think it's a male patient, in his retina. This year, February of this year, people are trying this for certain kinds of really debilitating muscular dystrophy. The idea here is to genetically alter cells that could be introduced into muscle and rescue deficits in muscle function. We're going to see a lot more of this in the next 5 years. You can count on. All right. One of the ones that I think ought to give us pause is this technology. Pigs have been genetically engineered by CRISPR-Cas9 editing of numerous genes that cause the pigs to immune reject human cells put into them. So the genetically engineered pigs, now, if you put human cells into these pigs, won't reject those cells. Okay? Now, why, you ask, would we want to do that? I'm glad you asked. Well, I'm not sure I'm glad, but this is the idea. And I think the title of this was from a newspaper in South Africa was Pigs Are Saving Our Bacon or something like that. Oh, Pigs Save Patients' Bacon, yeah. Oh, my goodness. That's just terrible. Okay, so the idea here is that we can put cells from a human that have been genetically engineered or whatever, iPS cells from a human patient, into a pig that's been genetically altered so that it will not reject those cells. And but what we do is to put the human cells into a pig embryo. They're a specific set of cells that will only make a particular organ rudiment, like a pancreas or a you name it. And then the pig grows up to pighood,
and now is carrying human cells in place of the pig cells that would have made that pig's organ. And then the organ can be harvested for transplantation. This raises huge ethical questions, I think.
Yeah.
You can see that this is getting more Jeff Goldblum-like, right? Yeah. Now, there's a good motivation, which is to treat human patients, of course. But this raises all kinds of questions about mixing human cells with non-human cells. What are we doing exactly? Okay. The biggest issue, though, is in the Broad, or the Beats Institute video, you saw that we can inject the components for CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing into a fertilized egg, and it will work. So that opens up the possibility of genetically altering an embryo. Now all of the cells in that embryo will have the genetic alteration, and when that embryo develops into a baby and then later into an adult, would pass those changes on reproductively in the germline, to use technical language. And we're pretty sure this will work. The reason for this is it works in monkeys. If it works in mice, eventually it's been shown to work in humans every time, pretty much. But if it works in monkeys, you can guarantee pretty much it's going to work. So these are cynomolgus macaques, is what I'm trying to say. They're not rhesus macaques, which is what I was about to say, but they're not rhesus. And these were genetically engineered using CRISPR-Cas9. Notice the date on this story is 2014. And it was dirt easy, as far as anybody can tell. So you take an unfertilized egg, an oocyte, and inject sperm that actually activates normal processes mimicking fertilization. And then you inject all the CRISPR-Cas9 stuff after waiting about 9 hours. You take that embryo, transfer it into a surrogate mother monkey, and wait the appropriate time for monkey development, and you get mutant monkeys. After it was shown that that was fairly straightforward in macaques, a Chinese group used this on human embryos. Now, these embryos had 3 copies of their genome, so they would never have been viable. But you see the concern. So this was published in a journal in 2015, and warning bells went off at that point. This is a friend of mine, Francis Collins. He's the director of the National Institutes of Health. And he was also instrumental in the sequencing of the human genome. And at that point, he issued a statement. The concept of altering the human germline and embryos for clinical purposes has been debated over many years from many different perspectives and has been viewed almost universally, emphasis on almost, as a line that should not be crossed. So that's a conservative position. In December of 2015, there was a summit of all of the moguls of CRISPR-Cas9 technology, including Fen Zhang here, who I've mentioned, and a number of others, George Church, Jennifer Doudna, I think Emmanuel Charpentier might have been there too. And they agreed on an approach here as kind of an international consortium. They agreed that this should not be used to modify human embryos intended for establishing a pregnancy. But the main reason was safety. It would be irresponsible to proceed with any clinical use of germline editing unless and until, one, relevant safety and efficacy issues have been resolved, and two, there is broad societal consensus. So we might reconsider this if we can show that it's safe and most people in society agree. They also call for cautious development of medical applications that cannot be passed on to offspring. This would be direct editing of cells that have disease, or the IPS kind of repair technologies that I've mentioned. All right, well, let's move the clock forward. 2016. The United Kingdom, which has kind of been at the forefront of embryo technologies relative to North America for sure, gave the green light to genetically modify human embryos as long as the embryos were not allowed to develop past 14 days.
for research purposes only. Frederick Lonner in Sweden announced, actually he published a paper that suggested where he wanted to go with this. He has a large program for research purposes to genetically edit human embryos. They would not be allowed to develop past 14 days or so for the purposes of research. And so that's got people thinking about, let's look at all the laws all across the U.S. and see where it's most likely somebody will actually try to make a baby that has been, whose genome has been edited. Okay? So this graphic shows where there's an outright ban, so it's illegal, places like Canada, Brazil, India, China, Australia, New Zealand, I should say. Germany has always had very conservative laws relating to genetic alterations that go back to the Nazi era and the eugenics program. There's a ban, but it's basically not enforceable in countries like China and India. There are restrictive guidelines, but this is mostly for federal research funding, and there are no laws. And there's a conspicuous country labeled number one that is in that state. That's the United States. It is not, you can do anything you want with CRISPR in this country. It's legal. You might not be able to receive NIH money, National Institutes of Health funding, but you can do the editing if you have the resources. You know, it's not clear when this is going to happen. It could happen offshore someplace. Somebody probably will try it reasonably soon. I don't know how soon, but I would guess with the young people in the audience, within your lifetime, someone will try it, I'm guessing. All right. So let's move forward to 2017. My UW-Madison colleague, Alta Charo, and Richard Hines from MIT, co-chair of National Academies of Science Committee, convened to kind of revisit the 2015 summit decisions. National Academy of Sciences is kind of the highest profile group of scientists in the U.S. And they call for prohibiting any alterations resembling enhancement. So that begs a big question, what is enhancement? They didn't really answer that. And in fact, clinical trials of germline alteration might be permitted, but only following much more research on risks and benefits, and only for compelling reasons and under strict oversight. Those situations could be limited to couples who both have serious genetic disease and for whom embryo editing is really the last reasonable option. That's what Alton Charles said. So, you can see that's not an outright ban on germline editing of humans, is it? No. Here's Alta, and to her credit, she said, look, we're really just codifying what the 2015 summit was basically talking about. I'm not sure that's true. We can debate that. We can talk about it. But she did say this. It's essential for public discussions to precede any decisions about whether or how to pursue clinical trials, and we need to have them now. We need to have those discussions now. That's why we're here tonight, is to raise your awareness so that you, as a citizen, can engage in these discussions, and in particular, as a Christian citizen. All right, now, some people are a little more avant-garde. This is George Church, great facial hair, and he said with envy. You know, he said this, he was part of this 2017 discussion. Look, while we're in there, if we're going to fix a genetic defect, why would small or large enhancements accompanying the fixes be unacceptable? This is kind of, you take your car in for engine repairs, you need a new fuel injector, oh wait, we're going to go ahead and turbocharge your exhaust system while we're in there. Right? And so at least some scientists are really thinking that enhancement is maybe not something that is all bad. Right, well, what does the public think about this? Well, I think it's hard to know what the public thinks because I don't think they understand the technology. And that's reality, and that's an educational issue for scientists. But the Pew Research Foundation in 2016 asked a question about enhancement. And here's the percent of U.S. adults with particular religious commitments, defined broadly, but would include people in this room, who say gene editing is meddling with nature and crosses a line we should not cross. People who have a high religious commitment, many of them would be Christians in the United States, you can see that 64% of them think this is a line we should not cross. Whereas people with low religious commitments are much more amenable to pursuing this technology. So people of faith need to be part of these discussions. I think one of the reasons is that they have the appropriate kinds of epistemic qualities as they think about their faith to engage in these discussions thoughtfully, and we'll get to that. All right, now there's another issue with the public, and that is that newspapers like to sell copy. And they like to perpetuate the notion that there's a magic gene that underlies every disease. If we could just find that gene and we could fix that gene, you wouldn't have disease. Unfortunately, that just doesn't jive with most genetics. And that's because there are many situations where something called pleiotropy is in play. That's a big genetic-y word, but the idea is very simple. That is that there's a single gene, provides information to make some protein. You know what? That protein does a lot of stuff. So it affects all kinds of traits in an individual. So I might really care about trait number one. There's a problem there. But if I mess with the gene, oh wait, I'm going to have all kinds of things happen to all of these other traits. So I can't just fix the one trait in many cases. Right? There's a flip side situation, and that's something that's a multigenic trait. What is that? Well, it's kind of the converse of this. In some cases, there's lots of genes that impinge on a particular set of traits. Brain function being a really good example of that. So there's all these genes, and they're all needed to get the normal trait that one sees. Okay? So you can see that I have to mess with all of these genes to affect this trait. Now, that might be possible with CRISPR-Cas9, I don't know, but it's going to make it much more difficult. So, the public needs to be educated to realize that genetics is more complicated than newspapers tend to imply. And that's hard. All right, so let's look at an example. Autism is a good example of a multigenic trait. It's very complicated. There are lots of genes which correlate with autism. And I've been following this literature extremely carefully because my 28-year-old son, this guy, has severe autism. His name's Christopher. So I've thought about this a lot. You cannot fix autism by editing a single gene. There are a couple of autistic syndromes that are due to one gene, but Christopher is not in that category. So most people with autism, it's a complicated genetic interaction that leads to the particular traits. So although this is a powerful technology, being simplistic about how biology works will not help us in the appropriate exercise of this technology. Right. Okay, so let's wind this up by bringing this home. This is a Christian audience. I'm at a public university. I don't get to have Christian audiences very much. So I'm really happy to be here. One of the key issues in all of this discussion, of course, is what does it mean to be human? And that's a difficult question to answer. Here's Jennifer Doudna, involved in the patent litigation, and she'll probably get a Nobel Prize one day, I would guess, for some of her work here. But people write to her, and one woman wrote her who has a Down syndrome son and explained, "I love my child, wouldn't change him. There's something about him that's so special." As Doudna was relaying this letter, she's teared up. And she said, you know, it makes you think hard about it, what it means to be human, doesn't it? And Doudna has identified one of the key issues. What is essential to being human? Biology is part of the input there, but our Christian faith informs us in ways that biology can't. So humans are image bearers. John Walton on this campus is really good at talking about what that means and the representational aspect of all of that.
But those image bearers are meant to be God's co-regents in the world, to act as his stewards. And procreation in that context is meant to be a one flesh relationship. Children are begotten gifts. They are not subjects for engineering, I think, in a biblical worldview. And that's in particular because the weak are given special attention, especially in a number of prophetic passages, the Pentateuch, and a number of other places. So humans are good, but we have certain responsibilities towards them because of that. But humans are also broken. They require restraint. Why? Because they have made bad choices. The Bible refers to that as sin, and the condition associated with that as fallenness. And that means we should only take life under divinely mandated circumstances. In particular, Christ died for each of us because of this condition, and we are called to share in Christ's sufferings in some way. And although I don't think we're going to develop that tonight, it's something to think about. Jesus ultimately is the real human, and he's the pattern of what it looks like to be a fully restored human. Well, given that backdrop, clearly a couple of things are out of bounds. One is the notion that science can fix everything. And in fact, I will call that view scientism, that science is the be-all and end-all of reality. An unlikely guy says that's poppycock. This is James Watson, one of the co-discoverers of the DNA double helix. There's that word DNA. He said it this way, the belief that surrogate mothers and clonal babies are inevitable because science always moves forward represents a form of laissez-faire nonsense, dismally reminiscent of the creed that American business, if left to itself, will solve everybody's problems. Science needs guidance. And that guidance must come from outside of science itself. And you see the way that the scientists are struggling with ethical decision making. They need help. And a second issue is the human difference. We touched on this with the pig human chimeric embryos thing, which is, we can talk about that in the Q&A. But here is, I don't know, this is Peter Singer. He's a well-known ethicist from Princeton. Here's his view of this engineering prospect. You know, in this respect, experimenting on a human embryo is not to be compared in significance with experimenting on a living, sentient mouse. So he sees no difference between genetically engineering a mouse and genetically engineering a human. I think from a biblical perspective, we would push back on Peter Singer's view. And that's because the Bible has a lot to say about the value of humans. Now, there's a problem, of course. The Bible doesn't know anything about early embryonic development or things called blastocysts or pluripotent cells or DNA. The Bible's pre-scientific, so its language doesn't give us the certainty we like about this. And as a result, let's be honest, that sincere Christians sincerely disagree on certain issues relating to these kinds of technologies. But I think the sum total of the biblical teaching suggests that Bible passages, while they may not establish the details of very early human development as precisely as we'd like, they establish God's care and involvement from the very beginning. And that ought to lead us to a healthy sense of restraint. Gil Mailander, who's a really great bioethicist at Valparaiso University, said it this way, if we're genuinely baffled about how best to describe the moral status of a human subject, who is the unimplanted embryo, we should not go forward in a way that peculiarly combines metaphysical bewilderment with practical certitude by approving even limited use for experimental purposes. So Mailander would not approve of the experiments going on in the UK and Sweden for this reason, because the embryo is not being treated as an end in itself. All right, ultimately, we ought to be seeking to protect human beings at all stages of their development, and we should seek to prevent disease. That's beneficence. The problem is certain technologies that apply to early human organisms, which might lead to beneficent treatments, run counter to the beneficence applied to those embryos themselves. And so both Christian obligations are in tension, and we have to work that out.
And moreover, we should recognize something that should make us very skeptical of certain kinds of technologies, and that is that humans are sinful. I think I maybe have a tendency to be optimistic about human behavior, and it's not well borne out by the facts. Humans are sinful. Powerful technologies in the hands of sinful human beings can go powerfully awry. We need to take that seriously. And here's Francis again. He said it this way in an interview. The application of germline manipulation, like what we've been talking about, would change our view of the value of human life. If genomes are being altered to suit parents' preferences, then children become more like commodities than precious gifts. He's not using biblical language, but Francis is a devout Christian. He's using Christian concepts, but talking to a wider audience here. And he said this about hubris. Humility would be a very good principle to attach to any such discussion. And I agree. Well, what are next steps here? Well, it's on you to be informed. Hope this has been helpful. Be critical thinkers. Don't swallow everything that you hear uncritically. And be loving advocates. If we're going to speak to our culture about the use of these technologies, we must do it in love. All right, that's all I want to say. Thanks very much for listening, and I'm happy to throw it open for questions.
We've got some time for questions.
I just can't help but think about the island of Dr. Moreau and the implications of this. I hope you guys, your ranks at the ASA really grow, because I think that'd be a nice bulwark in case of a dark satanic technocracy was to take hold in this country on a global scale and start interfering with our genes. So I can't only imagine that in the future they'll be able to splice in someone's DNA to make them not so aggressive or independent in their thinking and make them more passive to the state. I can only see that happening.
So the reference at the beginning was to a novel by H.G. Wells called The Island of Dr. Moreau, where Dr. Moreau was kind of combining humans and animals to make kind of hybrid organisms. Yeah. Well, so I think it's going to be true one day that we will know certain genes which lead to alterations in human behavior. And we'll know that through what's called genome-wide association studies. We'll learn about that. But we'll be able to manipulate the same genes in non-humans and see what they do to behavior. So we'll have a sort of an idea, and someone might try it. So you're right. I mean, it's possible. I think that's why the discussion needs to happen now before the technology actually becomes available. We're probably about 20 years out from doing that kind of thing. I don't know, though. It's moving so fast. I'm kind of concerned. Yeah,
I share your concern about there's no law in the United States prohibiting CRISPR-edited embryos and surrogacy and things like that. And I guess, you know, for the U.S. government, just the deduction maybe is the reason they have a law for that. But are there any, did the scientific societies agree that we should have a law at least regulating, not prohibiting, at least regulating, so that there's a, you know, IRB approval or ethics committee before anything like that happens? Or are they advocating for that?
I think they're advocating for regulation. Like the 2015 and 2017 summits both advocate for regulation, but they do not want. There was not consensus on whether we should apply a moratorium to these technologies. So, so I think it's going to be hard to get an outright ban in place. Although, our federal government right now, the Republicans control both houses, and we have a Republican president. If one were going to pass legislation, now would be the opportunity. I don't know what would happen to that legislation, but. So I think that will be interesting to see what happens there.
What has happened with other things, like there's no laws banning human cloning in the United States either, like making a, taking a nucleus, throwing it into a, an egg cell that doesn't have its nucleus to generate a genetic copy of someone. And that's because at the time, I think it was the Senate was controlled by the Democrats and the House by the Republicans. At the time that legislation came through in the early 2000s, and it only made it through one branch of Congress, one House of Congress. So, yeah, it's kind of, it's interesting. So the UK has laws prohibiting germline manipulation for the purpose of making babies. But you can see that they have a very open policy to doing research on human embryos as long as the embryos are destroyed after 14 days. So we in the U.S. have more restrictive policies about that destruction process. We don't. That tends to be something that more people in the United States are hesitant about. And but you're right, we just have this patchwork of legislation that's kind of baffling, right? So we'll see where that goes. You know, it might be that somebody tries this and people realize it's really terrible because there's just a horrible result. And then all of a sudden there'll be a push to pass legislation. I don't know. I hope that's not true. I would prefer that we are proactive as a nation in thinking about this stuff and putting the brakes on this stuff. I'm just worried about how fast this is moving. Personally. Yeah.
How serious are the discussions of possibly developing a superior species like Homo super sapiens?
Yeah, so the question is, how serious are the discussions about what's called, this is part of a larger discussion called transhumanism. So this is augmentation of humans. So one aspect of transhumanism is kind of cybernetic enhancements of getting implants in your brain or that sort of thing. But another approach would be to deliberately alter humans to make a new improved Homo sapiens 2.0 or something. And there are people, there's a serious movement that is strongly advocating for doing just this. So, and they tend to be much more vocal than the large majority of people who, if you polled them, would say that, no, we don't want to do that. And I would say, so, yeah, so, most of the discussion has been about mild enhancement. Like, maybe we could get everybody's lifespan up to 120 years with full brain function. That'd be a good goal. But that would require enhancement. Because people, on average, don't live 120 years with full brain function at age 120. There are a few people. They're the record holders. So we would have to do some sort of genetic manipulation to make that happen. Yeah, Norm?
Your presentation is so intriguing, tremendous, and yet the last point about should we have regulation, and how does a government that is all one party right now, how can we trust the outcome of that? Would we, if we tried to make a transhuman, would we perhaps lose the image of God? Do we really understand what is the image of God?
I will say the answer to that last one is no, I don't think we do. So one of the fundamental questions is, to what extent is the image of God biologically based? We can ask that question. And I think you'll get different answers. When you poll really smart, thoughtful Christian people about that. So that's a problem. I raise the issue that that image language needs to be part and parcel of how we think about this. How far we would go, where we would stop, how should we think about that? You know, if image is fundamentally representing the Creator, you could have... I'm not advocating for this, okay? In fact, I'm very conservative on this. I'm more in Francis's camp, for sure. But if it's just an ability to relate to the Creator, you could have human, Homo sapiens 2.0 would, in theory, be able to relate to God still. So I don't know how far you have to go until you no longer have a relatable being as far as a spiritual relationship with God. I am very wary of messing, though, with the fundamental kind of baseline of what humans are now. So I would want to advocate only for very limited uses for repair, not in the germline, at least. I mean, that's what I would advocate for. So I think the kind of regenerative medicine applications seem to be, if they're not for enhancement. So the problem is, it's the George Church problem. You know, once you're under the hood, let's make a few minor adjustments. Right? It's very tempting. Right? Yeah.
How do you balance assistance to someone who has a genetic problem? And on the other hand, you have the passing, if that's a somatic change, and then you have that defective gene passed on genetically, the Malthusian problem. How do you balance those two?
The idea that Tom is referring to goes back to a guy named Malthus. The idea is that I fix the somatic cells of, let's say, Tom. We'll just take Tom. So Tom's got some defect. It's a genetic defect. I fix Tom's problem in the cells of his body, but not in his sperm. So if he has more children, maybe Tom runs wild or something, decides he wants to have a bunch more children, he's going to pass that defective gene on to his children. So we saved Tom, so he didn't die, so now he can pass on the bad gene. So we're kind of polluting the gene pool, if you will. So, people have talked about that a lot. I don't know what the answer is. I think we already have technologies that allow us to circumvent certain genetically based defects. There aren't a ton of those examples, but I mean, I would say to prevent someone like that from passing his defective genes onto his offspring, you have to legislate against him being able to do so. And I think most Christians would not want to go there. There were forced sterilizations in the early part of the 20th century in this country and elsewhere. Based on a similar logic, we would say that logic was flawed based on a faulty idea of defect in those cases. But the lines get really murky, so I think we're all nervous about ever suggesting we would want to do that.
Let's take one more question, if you have a...
Sure. Thinking about the idea of how best to move forward with this, and there seem to be a lot of advocates for legislation to try to say that's enough, no human embryo. But I think the strategy you're doing here of education and conversation is a much better technique. That this is a technology that for, you know, $50,000, $100,000 in a setup lab, you can give this a shot anywhere around the world. And so setting a law in the United States is not going to stop this, but enough conversation, enough education can help us as a society make a decision on this. So thank you.
You're welcome. You know, I think Alta Charles made the point that it's the Jeff Goldblum situation. You can go off the coast of Costa Rica, and that's where Jurassic Park happens, right, where there are no laws. I would want to say one thing about laws. They may not be 100% enforceable, but they make a statement about what a society stands for. When you pass a law, it is saying that a majority of your citizens, through whatever legislative process and how they select legislators, etc., that they believe that they are espousing a value. So I would say in certain cases, although a law might not be 100% enforceable, it's making a statement that is an important statement to make. Does that make sense? I'm not naive about enforcement, because you have the garage biohacker phenomenon now. Yeah, you're right. These are tough issues, really tough issues. I think some people on both sides of this issue feel like if you pass certain laws, all of a sudden it will set in stone what's going to happen. That's probably a naive way to think about how law works. Yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah, I think you're probably right. And we definitely need lots more discussion with many more people in the room talking about this stuff.
Right.
That's absolutely true.
and thoughtful Christian voices have to be part of that conversation. So that means we have to go off the Wheaton campus, which is a great place, but out into Chicagoland or wherever else you want to go, Naperville, or and talk about these things with people who have different worldviews. And that means we have to advocate for our worldview. That's hard work.
That's right. Let's thank Dr. Harden for